Support for Access Utah comes from the Utah Humanities Council, enriching cultural, intellectual, and civic life by providing opportunities for all Utahns to explore life's most engaging questions and the wonders of the human experience. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle. We're back with the gardening segment for the rest of the year, and our first guest is Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan, and we invite your questions and comments at 1-800-826-1495. Well, welcome, Mark. Yeah. Nice to have you here for the first program.
Thanks for the invitation.
So what do we talk about during the winter?
You know, there's a lot to do. In fact, we've got some herbs that we've already started at the store, and we've got, the heat mats are starting to warm up so we can germinate some seeds, and I've got my light fixtures in. I've got some really cool new lights. So a couple things that we're very excited about at the store, but about 3 weeks ago, we started some herbs. Probably should have done a little bit sooner. I kind of wanted them ready to go by the first part of the year, so for right now. But they're a little small. We're just going to transplant them here in a little bit. But a lot of people are growing indoor herb gardens, and very easy to do. You've got some nice fresh herbs growing in your window box. You can just kind of pick and use as you feel like it. Because, we've got a couple months of crummy weather still, even though it has been really nice recently. But I would suspect that's going to change.
Kind of crummy cold.
Yeah. It has been, especially cold at night, but not a whole lot of snow on the ground. So that's hopefully a sign that we might have a little earlier spring this year than we have the last 3 years.
We certainly haven't had one for the last couple of years.
Yeah. It's been about three. Yeah. It's been 3 years since we've been able to start anything really in March. Normally a lot of people are out gardening, starting to get their early crops in March and sometimes even late February, depending on what the winter brings. But the last 3 years we haven't been able to do that. It's been the first of April to get, peas, spinach, lettuce, radishes, onions, all the cold crops in. And we just haven't been able to do that for the last couple of years. But this month is a great time to start some of those cold crops indoors if you want to put them outside as soon as the snow melts. Because cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli can handle the cold. So as long as your soil's workable, you could transplant those plants out. Say you start them the middle of this month and our snow melts around the 10th of March, which is, fairly normal. You could transplant those out. They'd be, 6 to 8 week old seedlings, and they could be transplanted right outside into the garden. They'd do just fine. Of course, we'd have to harden them off a little bit.
It's slightly, yeah. And it's guaranteed to snow again sometime.
Yeah, but they could do that. Onions work really well that way. We've done lettuces and spinach transplants just in, just little tray packs just right there in the windowsill, and it works great. Works really well.
Well, so tell me, are there certain varieties that do better like that with transplantation than others? Or is it generally, if you decide you want to start lettuce indoors, they're all going to be about the same?
They're all going to be about the same on the lettuces. The cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, there's no problem with those. We've had no problem doing onions. The onions will transplant just super. They'll be great. Peas are not so hot.
Yeah, they don't tend to like that too.
Yeah, much. I've had people try and do the pea transplants before, and they just don't seem to do that well. In fact, I think it's easier to just stick them out there in the ground and let them do their thing. So we usually wait on the peas until we can get out and work the soil and plant those. But it's way too early for peppers and tomatoes, and we won't want to do those for at least another month or two. Generally, tomatoes were starting around first part of March or so. So they'll be ready to go out by the first part of May. So just the early crops for flowers, pansies. I've got a lot of customers who are starting their own pansies indoors, and they'll be ready to transplant out when the weather's, a little bit more amicable for us.
Now, how are pansy seeds? Because I know, as far as cost, because I know that there are some seeds out there that are just prohibitively expensive for the home gardener to do. I don't know if petunias are still as bad as
petunias
they used to
aren't
be,
so bad. The petunias are still a little bit more expensive, but really not too bad. I'm thinking you can get about 100 seeds for around $4 or $5.
That's still a lot.
That's a lot, but that's not too bad when you think you only get like 48 in a flat.
Yeah.
And you're paying $17, $18 for a flat. That's not too bad.
What about begonias?
Begonias aren't too bad. It just depends on the varieties. Like,
okay.
Some of the pansies, like Swiss Giants, I carry the Swiss Giants in bulk, and they're really inexpensive. I think you can probably get, 100 seeds for 90 cents or a dollar. I mean, they're really quite inexpensive. Geraniums and petunias tend to be a little bit more. Some of the geranium seeds end up running around, anywhere between 5 and 10 cents a piece. On some of those, the nice seedling geraniums, but compared to $3.49 per plant for a zonal in season, that's a big difference. Really, when it comes down to it, if you're planting a lot of flowers and you enjoy starting them and doing them inside, then it's worth it for you to start your own. If you're just going to do a few of these and a few of those, it's really. Cost-wise, it's not going to save you a whole lot of money, but if you enjoy doing it and it's fun and it's a hobby that you really like, then it's totally worth it. It's totally worth it. I think in the long run, if you're not doing too many, it's really not a money-saving setup, but it's fun to do, and it can be really enjoyable.
So what are the really expensive seeds? It's been several years since we talked about this, but I can't remember which ones were out of this world.
Like wave petunias. Are exceptionally expensive.
That's probably what I was remembering.
Yeah.
How much are those?
The waves are probably about 15 cents a piece, I think is about where they're running right now. There's a lot of the proprietary plants, especially from, say, Proven Winners or what's the other one I was thinking of? They only do them in plugs, so you really can't buy seeds for them. So we'll have customers come in all the time, and they're wanting seeds for the supertunias, or they want seeds for some of the newer varieties of like Deasia or Terenia, or some of the really new exciting premium annuals that have been coming out in the last few years, and the seed's just not available. You can buy little plugs, but you have to buy 288 at a time.
So unless they have a large bed.
Yeah, and so so those are definitely a little bit more cost prohibitive. But that's because they've been recently introduced into the market, and a lot of research and development has gone into those, and so those are protected varieties. But petunias and geraniums tend to be a little bit more expensive. There are some varieties of marigolds that are a little bit more expensive. And some of the newer zinnias, like what is it? Profusion. Have you ever grown the Profusion?
I love the Profusion because
they're
so easy to grow.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't have to deadhead them. And I get the best comments whenever I put a row of even just different colors, doing some of the apricot and the white and the cherry.
Oh, they're great. They're great. But those tend to be a little bit more expensive too. So there's a lot of newer flowers that are out that are really, really fun to grow, but they will be a little bit more expensive than just your run-of-the-mill average flowers.
But as far as the easiest to germinate, if you're looking at annuals, what flowers are the easiest to go with?
When we have people come in and they want to do like a little project for their class and start some seeds indoors and have a little flower, usually we'll direct them to zinnias, like say the Thumbelina we don't usually want to do the tall ones, but the Lilliput or the Thumbelina zinnias are really easy. And some of the marigolds, like Sparky has a shorter marigold, or Brocade, which they've been around for a long time. So they're really inexpensive. I mean, you can buy a packet of, 150 seeds for a dollar or so. So they're very, very inexpensive and fairly easy to germinate. I think the zinnias are about as easy as anything.
And you've got a lot of bulk.
Yeah,
seeds,
yeah,
so.
Yeah. So we've got our seed list. We're updating with all of the new varieties that we have coming in, scheduled to come in right now, and pretty much I'd say we've got about 80%, maybe 85% of our seeds in for this year. I know I've got a big shipment coming in this week, and probably another one coming in next week, and by the end of this month we should have just about everything ready to go. There'll be a few things that'll straggle in after that. Some companies are, some of the varieties are a little slow to be available, but probably by the end of this month, 1st of February, everything will be ready to go.
Yeah. So what's new? What's popping out at you this year as far as flowers are concerned? Anything?
For flowers, I haven't really seen anything.
I mean, like when the Profusion series came out, it was like, wow, this stuff's really cool.
Yeah.
Anything like that?
I didn't really see anything big this year. I think with the economy slowing down the last few years, that development kind of slowed down as well too. And so now as the economy starts to pick up, we're not seeing as many new introductions because I just don't think they had the money available to do as much research and to introduce a lot of these new varieties that they did for quite a few years there. And the mid-2000s, and it seemed like every year there was like 5 or 6 or 10 new varieties that were being introduced from different companies, and things have kind of slowed down that way a little bit. But I think that'll probably start to pick up as the economy starts to improve, and as some of these developers really have the funds that they didn't have the last few years to try and introduce some new things. You know, as for peppers, this year we've got a new pepper coming in, and it's called Scorpion. And the Scorpion pepper,
be red.
It is like super, super hot. This is like the second hottest pepper in the world, supposedly. Yeah. Changes all the time, though. I think, I don't think there's, I mean, the Scoville scale works pretty well on heat, but I don't think it's as accurate as they'd like it to be. So some of these super hot peppers are, it's hard to tell.
So hotter than a habanero?
Yeah, like 4 times hotter than a habanero.
Wow.
Yeah, so we're going to have hot pepper days probably right around Cinco de Mayo. We'll have some of these Scorpion pepper plants ready. So if you're interested in some of these hot, hot peppers, you know, like the ghost pepper and the Naga pepper and the Scorpion, they're all kind of in this same family, so which is called a Jolokia.
Who purchases these really hot peppers? Are they transplants from like Arizona, or just people who are really interested to see, okay, how hot is this really?
Yeah, a lot of these really, really hot ones are coming from Asia, from the Indian area, right around India, and there are some really hot ones. Yeah, some very hot ones. Hot enough that I really don't want to touch them, because you get some of that oil on your hands and touch your face, and it's not very nice.
But why do you want to grow it?
People are just interested in growing. Supposedly they have really good, rich flavor, but they have just a ton of heat, so you don't have to use very much of it to
get
the heat.
Okay, so you just use like one.
Yeah,
one,
you're just using a tiny amount of it to get the heat, but they have amazing flavor. So we've had a lot of people over the last few years becoming more and more interested in some of these really hot peppers.
Is it the seeds where that comes from? If you're dealing with the pepper, is it the seeds you don't want to handle too much? It seems like in the back of my mind.
I think the seeds tend to be a little bit hotter, mm-hmm. Yeah, but I think it just depends on each variety, because some it's just the pepper itself is just incredibly hot. So.
And as my wife learned the hard way, if your eye itches, don't itch it with your fingers.
After you've touched the hot peppers.
The hot peppers, yeah. So.
So that will be quite... That'll be quite interesting. That should be a lot of fun to do. Haven't seen any, crazy... exciting new tomatoes that just made me jump up and say, gotta have that. So it'll be interesting this year. We've got a few new things. We're gonna try a couple samples of some stuff that'll be coming out in the next year or two. We'll see how good those are. But again, some of the companies that have really been heavy on producing new varieties, through the 1990s and through the early 2000s, just haven't put out that much the last couple of years. So I really think that has to do with the slowdown in the economy.
Well, coming up, we're going to talk about back timing, looking at the number of days to maturity so you know exactly when to plant and get ready for outdoors. Yeah. But first, we have just a little break, and then we'll be back for another 15 minutes or so with Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
This is Linda Kirvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society. What predatory bird can guide a screaming 200-mile-per-hour freefall dive to intercept a flying duck, killing it with a blow from a fist of talons? Tornado winds howl at 200 miles per hour. Even flying horizontally, this bird can accelerate to 70 miles per hour. No animal is faster. It must therefore be a falcon, in today's case, the peregrine falcon. This species inhabits all continents but Antarctica. The peregrine likes cliff ledges for nesting, such as the high basalt walls at the Birds of Prey Refuge along the Snake River near Boise. In such places, listen for its call, which is very similar to this prairie falcon. 50 years ago, the peregrine falcon was in a different dive, a plunge to extinction. The culprit was DDT. It wasn't poisoning the birds, but it insidiously interfered with birds' calcium metabolism, leaving thin-shelled eggs that broke under brooding parents. DDT is persistent. Worse, DDT bioaccumulates in fats of species high on the food chain, birds like falcons, eagles, and pelicans. Robins provided the first persuasive evidence of DDT bioaccumulation. On December 28, 1973, President Nixon signed the Endangered Species Act into law. The peregrine falcon was immediately listed. DDT use in the United States was banned. Worried wildlife researchers undertook a bold program to rescue intact eggs from cliff-face nests. The captive nestlings were raised up and taught to hunt. Over the years, 1,600 peregrines were released into the wild. The peregrine's population plunge was halted, then reversed. In 1999, it was formally delisted. By 2003, 3,000 pairs bred in Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Peregrines have never been common, but today you are 4 times more likely to see a peregrine falcon in Utah than 30 years earlier. You can see similar rebounds in red-tailed hawks, brown pelicans, and other predatory birds by going to the website of the National Audubon Christmas Bird Counts. This is an environmental success story worth celebrating. This is Linda Kirvin for Bridgerland Audubon Society.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah comes from the College of Natural Resources at Utah State University. Information is at cnr.usu.edu.
Okay, welcome back. I'm Brian Earle, your host, and Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden is in studio. We're waiting for your phone calls as well. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. And we're talking gardening. It's the first gardening show of the year. Mark, let's talk about what I would call back timing. Which is an industry term in recording, you have to know exactly when you're putting a piece together and you want to use some music, exactly how much time you have. So with planting, you've got to know how long things take to germinate and harvest. So if you want to start indoors, that's probably a good number to know right on hand.
Actually, I have a really nice resource that, of course, that we are out of right now, our gardening calendar. That we actually talked about on the show in December.
Is it online yet?
I've got it. I've got the first 4 months of the year online.
Okay.
So those are up and going. So you can actually go onto our webpage and look at the Google Calendar in there, which is in our news and information section, and you can see all those dates in there. But it'll actually tell you when to start your plants inside, so they'll be ready to go outside. With some of your really quick growing ones, like squashes and melons, they don't need a whole lot of time at all. We're only starting those usually about 3 or 4 weeks before we want to transplant those outside. Tomatoes, they usually take about 6 weeks, maybe 8 weeks maximum to have those ready, so you don't want to start those too early. So again, the first or middle part of March is probably a very good time to start those and get those going. Peppers take a little bit longer. Now, they germinate about the same amount of time, but they're just a little slower progressing, so we usually start those a little bit earlier. I think probably around the middle part of February, towards the latter part of February, first part of March is a good time to start the peppers. Cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, right away, fairly soon. You could start those, by the end of this month and have them ready to transplant out by the middle part of March. And that works really quite well. So those are kind of the highlights. I'd say those are usually the most important plants that people are looking for to start on their own.
What about artichokes?
Artichokes are awfully slow as well.
So I should have started them last month?
I think I'd probably start those towards the end of this month. and have those ready to go. And then, have you wintered them over before?
Do you know, I haven't until this year. So I've got bags of leaves over the top of them. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, and it's been a consistently cold year, but it hasn't been like super super cold.
Right.
So I think that's probably going to be a good thing. A lot of our gardeners have dug them up in the past. You know, they'll dig them up and, you know, clean the roots off, kind of like they would with a dahlia bulb, mm-hmm. and store those in the basement until, you know, March or so, and then start them up and then transplant them out in May. And that has worked really, really well. So usually the second year and the third year, they just go gangbusters. You know, the first year they produce, you know, maybe 5 or 6 flowers or so, but then they'll like do triple that the next year. So they'll just go like crazy. So,
although you still have to determine whether it's worth all the work to get the little bit of meat out of each one of those.
I know what you're saying,
but it's something that's different. That's why I kind of like doing it.
It's funny. I've had people come in and they say, "My neighbor's growing this plant. It looks like this giant thistle." You know, it's like, "What is it?" And I say, "Well, bring me a picture." And then they bring it in. It's like, "Oh, it's an artichoke." You know, it does. It looks like a giant weed.
So. And the flowers are pretty if you happen to let it go, but
They are pretty. Yeah, they're really pretty. So they're pretty fun. So it's important that you start your stuff on, you know, within a reasonable amount of time. It's like if on our calendar it says on the 14th of February you should be starting this. I mean, you've got a couple of weeks, you know, before that and a couple of weeks after that where you're still in that prime, you know, seed starting time. Sometimes we take things a little bit too literal. You know, we got to start it on this particular day, but you've got some lead time. And
or if you like me, you've got to lock yourself into those dates, because if you don't, then you put it off and then it's
never
too late.
You'll never do it. I guess it goes both ways. That's for sure. But we do have like our seed list, which has like all of our seed varieties listed on it. On the back side of the seed list, it has a planting guide. And the planting guide will tell you how much time it takes for some of these seeds to germinate and you know, how much time to maturity as well, too. And so it's a good way to start the year off having some you know, a resource to help you know when to start your plants and when things should be ready to go outside, when to start your transplant. So it's really got a lot of good information for gardeners in our area on it as well. So,
well, let's talk about some of the things that you need to have in order to get those seeds started.
Yeah. So when we started our herbs last month, we got one of our heat mats. And the heat mats come in a couple different sizes, so they're made to fit either a traditional 10x20-inch flat, you know, like you'd buy your plants in at any nursery, but then they also will do 2 flats, so they're 20x20. Or else I've got a 4-flat one, which is 20x40. You know, essentially it's a good size mat. It's almost 4 feet long, and we've got thermostats that you can plug the mats into that will control the temperature. So it'll keep the temperature at whatever setting you want to put it on. So if you want it at 75 degrees, you can set that on the thermostat and it will regulate the electricity that goes into the heat mat and it'll control the temperature so it stays consistently at 75 or 70 or whatever you want to set it at. And that really, really helps. You know, having a good heat source that's not too hot, but keeps the soil warm is essential to get some of these seeds to germinate, especially some of the finicky flowers, you know, some of the petunias and geraniums and some of the herbs. I mean, our basil just jumped out of the ground. I mean, it was like 3-4 days and it was up. But we've got some chives and some parsley that are just slow.
Well, and even some of the coal crops
cooperative,
like to have the heat as far as
they do.
They'll
germinate at cooler temperatures. You know, so like your cabbage, cauliflower, and broccoli will germinate at 30, 40 degree soil temperatures, but it just takes a lot longer. And it's just much, much slower. So if you can control that temperature of the soil, keep it at 70 degrees, your seeds will all germinate much, much better.
So what's the advantage to germinating your own seeds? I mean, why not just wait?
You can wait and just get the plants. But again, I think it's the fun factor. It's definitely enjoyable and rewarding to start your own plants.
I'd imagine probably selection as well. If there's certain
sometimes
ones
you can't get varieties, yeah. And that's usually what we will start ourselves. And when it comes down to it, if we're doing, you know, a couple big beef tomatoes and a couple celebrity tomatoes and a couple, you know, I don't know, Best Boy or whatever. We have those by the thousands as they come in. It's not worth it for us to grow those because I can just grab a single or a four pack off the shelf and away we go. But when it comes to some of the specialty plants that we really have a hard time getting, if we want to do some Cherokee purple tomatoes or Kellogg's breakfast, or there's a lot of different varieties out there that people like to grow that are maybe some of the heirlooms or some less popular varieties that they really like. And those are the ones that you really have to start yourself when it comes down to it. We've got a variety of cabbage that we really like, but nobody grows it. It's called Columbia. And that's probably one of our favorite cabbages, but we can't find anybody growing it. So we have to start that one ourselves. Roadside cantaloupe. There's no growers that want to touch it because it's like $1,000 a pound.
You're kidding.
Oh, no. And so we grow those
ourselves.
But it's
like the best cantaloupe.
That's the best cantaloupe there is. Yeah, it's an expensive one. And so most of the growers
But it's been around for so long. Why is it so expensive? Because everybody likes it.
That's just the way, it's just the
they
way
know
it
they
is.
Can sell
yeah.
It.
Yeah, hard to propagate, apparently. But it is. It's one of our favorite cantaloupes, and we start those ourselves.
And it's huge.
Yeah.
You get these huge, productive plants.
One of the best. But Burpee Hybrid's just as expensive, and Burpee's Ambrosia. So a lot of the really good melons just tend to be.
I'd say Ambrosia's good,
pricey.
But I quit growing Burpee Hybrids. I tried it a couple years, and the dumb things, if you don't pick them exactly right,
they go soft.
They go really soft.
They go soft. But the flavor is wonderful on it. Yeah. I don't know if you get them when they're ripe. So it's varieties like this that we like to start ourselves and have those going because we can't always find them somewhere else.
Well, and you carry ones that the people tend to like a lot of. You've got the roadside in bulk. So it's a little less expensive than just getting one package of seeds.
Oh, yeah, much, much less expensive. So you can get probably 20, 25 seeds for right around $1, which is very, very, very reasonable.
Oh, and that's plenty.
Oh, it's a ton. Yeah. So that's a lot of seeds. Yeah. For a lot of people, they don't realize that's a lot of seeds. So there's a couple cucumbers that we like to start, like Orient Express. That's still hands down one of my favorite cucumbers. So we'll start those ourselves. And a few varieties of tomatoes. And there's a couple squashes. I've got a new winter squash you might want to try. It's called Magic Mix is what it's called. And they're smaller. They look like Hubbards, but they're smaller. And the mix—they
don't taste like Hubbards, do they?
They're supposed to be really, really good.
Sorry, I've never been a winter squash person until just recently.
Okay.
I like the smaller winter squash type things, but my mother just adored.
Yeah, well, these are
Hubbards, and
these are smaller, so I'd say smaller than a volleyball.
Okay,
so
they're round.
Yeah, so round, and they come orange and green and blue in the mixture, and it's called the Magic Mix.
And they're good keepers?
Really good keepers, yeah. Really good keepers.
That's what I love.
Probably about the size of a buttercup squash is what I would say. Maybe a little bit bigger than a buttercup. But this will be a fun mix to try. We've, the last few years, we've started bringing in more mixes. So we've got, of course, our lettuce mix, and we've got our radish mix, and we've got our rainbow carrot mixture, and we've got our mixture of rainbow chard, and they've really become very popular. People kind of like to have that variety of different colors and different shapes and sizes and things coming up right in the same group. So
the bright lights chard, and that stuff will recede. I have not had to plant it in the last 4 years.
It kind of just keeps
coming back
because
I don't usually till that particular area, and it just keeps coming back.
Go. Yeah, and it is a biennial, so it will come up again the next year and go to seed. And it usually doesn't taste as good. But our biggest problem with the chard is we very rarely get to eat it because the deer come and just massacre it.
They're like tulips.
Yeah, so if we plant enough chard, it'll keep the deer busy. They leave the other stuff alone.
Now, do they do with the chard like they do with the tulips? They just come along and nip the best parts off?
Oh, yeah. With the chard, they'll just mow it right down to the ground sometimes. They really like the chard. So we've been feeding the neighborhood flock.
What do you do to keep them out, other than putting in an 8-foot fence?
We've had really good luck with just some smaller metal fencing that we've put around and over. So we took chicken wire, or we took like a 4 or 5 foot field fence, and we just kind of bent it into an angle and just laid it over the plants, and that's worked really, really well. We've had very good results with that. So we kept them out of our cucumbers that way, and we kept them off our cabbage that way, just kind of bending that wire and putting it over, and that's worked really well. There are some good repellents you can use very safely in the garden as well too. So I've got some granulated ones that you can use on plants that are lower to the ground that tend to last a little bit longer. And then I've got some sprays you can use on some of the taller stuff as well too. But we've had good results with both. And it's just that the granulated forms, if your plants are 4 or 5 feet tall, they don't work as well, because the deer will just come and nibble on those, and they just don't ever smell the repellent strong enough to scare them off. But the liquid ones you can apply wherever, and that seems to work really well.
Well, I'll have you back in again. Let's say we'll have you back in before March anyway. Yeah. But in March, we'll talk about some of these different repellants, because that's when the tulips are coming up. And there actually are a number of products that have started to come out in the last couple of years.
Oh yeah, pretty well. There's some very good new ones that are seeming to be very effective and also not too expensive. So good for bang for your buck.
I wanted to buck. I get it. Yeah. I wanted to ask you kind of. Shifting the conversation here just a little bit, Diva, do you grow many of or have many of the All America winners in?
Yeah, we do. Like Diva's a cucumber.
That's
from
a cucumber
couple years
that,
ago.
That I've started growing, and my wife and I just love it because it's so prolific.
Yeah, that's one that I don't have, but I do have the Fanfare, which was another All America Award winner,
and that's a great one.
Yeah, so we do try and bring a lot of those in when they're available. Some of the companies not as available as others, and sometimes it takes a little while for them to catch on as well too. But as those introductions are made, we try and bring those new varieties in.
And you mentioned some of the squashes. There have been a number of new selections that have come out.
Oh yeah,
like the Honey Bear hybrid, the little those acorn squash.
Mm-hmm.
They've there's a couple of buttercups that have, and is it Chiboka squash? Is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah.
So.
It just depends on who has developed the seed, because sometimes they're just not as available as others. And sometimes it takes a year or two for the seed production to increase enough to justify the demand as well too. So they'll develop a new variety, and it'll get tested, and it'll be awarded this great award, you know, as being an All America Award winner. But the availability of the seed just isn't there right off the bat. And this is kind of what happened with Perfusion Zinnia, because Perfusion was selected as an All America winner, and that first year or two it was so hard to get the seeds. We couldn't get seeds anywhere. And then over the course of a couple years, all of a sudden production was up to where the seed was much more available. And then, of course, the price dropped down a little bit too. So that always helps.
And while you're on the Perfusion, how many varieties are there? And there used to be white, but there was cherry, there was Perfusion orange, and Perfusion, I guess it was white. Yeah. But now there's
six or
Perfusion
seven.
Perfusion apricot.
Yeah, I think there's six or seven now. And just the great thing about it is they just flower and flower and flower. They don't get too tall, and they're very mildew resistant. And they just don't get mildew. Like most other zinnias just are hammered by the mildew throughout the year, and Perfusion resists that. So that's a really nice plant.
The earwigs seem to really like the blossoms, but with one thing I noticed is they don't tend to damage them too much either. So because they're so prolific.
If you're getting earwigs in your blossoms on your zinnias, you probably have thrips.
Ah, and I usually plant my zinnias by the dahlias.
And,
the lighter dahlias get thrips.
Yeah, they always get thrips. So that's probably why the earwigs are there, because they love the thrips. So if you're seeing earwigs crawling all over your plants, you probably have thrips.
Look for thrips.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, we've reached the end of our time already.
Very good.
You've been listening to Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in our first gardening segment of the year. Coming up in the last 20 minutes of the program, Tom Williams will be discussing the cause of sudden aspen decline with Stanford University researcher and doctoral student William Anderegg, as well as University of Utah biologist John Sperry. So stay tuned.
Add a bit of nutrition and beauty to your patio, deck, or balcony with a pot of strawberries. It's a great way to keep a nutritional snack close at hand. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. The runners, flowers, and fruit on June, also called spring bearing, and the day neutral strawberries make for an attractive hanging basket. Set plastic pots inside a decorative container for added beauty. Or use a traditional strawberry pot. Consider growing ever-bearing plants that produce several harvests and no runners. Start your traditional strawberry pot by setting a tube or two of perforated PVC down the center of the strawberry pot. As you water, the water travels through the pipe and out the holes, providing moisture to all plants from top to bottom. Then place a bit of soil on the bottom of the container. Slide the plants through the hole from the inside of the pot. Fill the remaining space with soil. Gently tamp and water thoroughly to eliminate air pockets. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now with new hours, open Monday through Saturday 7 until 3 and Saturday 8 until 3. Offering a changing menu of French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits and serving lunch sandwiches.
Thanks for staying with us on Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We conclude the program with sudden aspen decline. You recall the many reports you've likely have seen in the 2000s, early 2000s, a drought, and many aspen trees started dying off. Of course, the aspen is an icon of the West, and researchers wondered why this sudden aspen decline became known as SAD for short. And researchers now think that they have found the cause for that die-off. It may have implications for the future, not only for aspens, but for other trees in the West and elsewhere. And those findings have been recently published. We are joined next by William Anderegg, who is a Stanford researcher and doctoral student. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by University of Utah biology professor John Sperry. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
So let's start with you. I'm not sure. Do you go by Bill?
Yeah, I go by Bill.
Okay, all right. We'll call you Bill. You noticed, I've been reading, that the forest that you grew up with in southwestern Colorado had been very much changed. Tell us about that.
Certainly. It actually was part of the motivation for this project, but essentially I'm a native of southwest Colorado, and I grew up with my family essentially camping and fishing and hunting in these aspen forests. This is down in the Four Corners area. And returning to these forests in around 2007, 2008 as a researcher, it was very striking. There was a profound difference that a lot of these forests I had grown up in were simply just were dying, with large swaths of forest already dead. And it really triggered my interest as to what's going on with sudden aspen decline and what does this mean for aspens in the future.
And I'm sure concurrently, Professor Sperry, you were wondering about this as well. Many reports, and not only aspens, but aspen is an icon.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of this decline has been popping up all over the western U.S., and it's anytime you get a pattern like that, you know, people start wondering what's going on with these trees.
Now, Bill Anderegg, how bad has this gotten? I'm reading that in some areas up to a fifth of the aspens have died off.
Yeah, that's what we know right now. It's The data we have come from aerial surveys that the Forest Service does, and it really looks like it is a phenomenon that has occurred across the western U.S., but it seems to be most severe in western Colorado. And from that, those aerial surveys, in fact, we know that essentially it seems to affect about a fifth, about 20% of aspen trees in western Colorado.
So tell us, before we get into some of the science, just describe for us some of these forests, maybe before and after, earlier on, and then when you've studied them recently.
Certainly. So one thing that very much distinguishes sudden aspen decline is not only the regional scale, that it's happening almost across much of the continent, but also that it's quite severe in local areas, that essentially in certain clones, aspen are a clonal organism that's all connected by their roots. You really do see 70, 80, even 100% of the trees dying in a certain area. And so essentially what it looks like before, if you walk into these forests, and as I did growing up, is that it's a just a closed canopy of a shady canopy completely filled with lush aspen leaves and trees, and then you walk in after, and it's almost like you're walking through it in winter. It's a skeletal forest with almost no leaves and bark falling off.
So it is very noticeable. You don't have to cut open the tree to find out that there's something serious going on here.
It's quite noticeable, and in fact, it's fairly noticeable as you drive by. Essentially, driving by these stands, you can see just a lot of these dead trees poking up. Now, it's a little harder to see than some of the other tree die-offs we've had, like the lodgepole pines or the pinyon pines, because those turn bright red when they die. Mm-hmm. This, you still have a fairly green understory, so it almost masks the severity in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that you had two theories going in as to why.
Yeah, it's certainly. Essentially, we're at the very early stages of our understanding of how trees die during drought, and there were two broad theories put forward as to how trees died. Essentially, I think of them roughly as they either starved during drought or they died of thirst. And how the starvation idea works is that as the soil and the air get dry, trees just close their pores on leaves through which they lose water. This helps them sort of maintain the water that they have. But potentially, because they're no longer doing photosynthesis and making their own food, they could starve. They could run out of their food supplies. The other would be that maybe they don't close these pores well enough or quickly enough, and in fact, they just get too much water strain on their systems that move water from their roots to the leaves, and in fact, these systems can break down. This is a process known as hydraulic failure. So these were the two overarching hypotheses that we went in to test. Did it look like these aspen trees really ran out of food, or did they die of this thirst?
We're talking with Bill Anderegg, who is a doctoral student and a Stanford researcher, and with the University of Utah biology professor John Sperry. We're talking about the reason for sudden aspen decline. Researchers say they have found that reason. We'll do a sort of a suspense here, the rest of the story, because we do have a caller on the line. And let's go next to Brian in Hyde Park.
Yeah, this may be too early to tell, but one, I've been wondering, do aspen communities, since they're clonal communities, do they intermix with each other so that if you have the sudden decline in one, could the other community be a little bit stronger? I mean, could there be some natural selection that's going on? Because you said, what was it, 85%? Goes away. What about the other 15%? Are they then hit the next year, or will a stronger community come back? Are you able to tell that at this point?
It's a little too early to tell whether they're going to come back and actually what happens to those remaining trees. But it is definitely true that they do mix. In fact, it seems that you can have sort of an intermingling of these different individuals. These clones are actually different individuals. And I certainly suspect that there is going to be some variation among individuals just due to genetic differences. So it's a little early to tell whether there will be more resistant clones or perhaps these last, 15 to 20% of trees that are still alive are actually probably on their way out. That's a possibility, too.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate that call. You can call as well as at 800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. That's toll-free anywhere we're listening. We talk about sudden aspen decline, and researchers think they've found the reason. Hydraulic failure. So let me turn to University of Utah biologist John Sperry. Tell us a little bit about this hydraulic failure.
Yeah, well, it kind of came about as a hypothesis based on a lot of work that we and others have done on the vascular system of plants, and basically we found that, like people, plants have heart attacks when they're under stress, and in the case of plants, the pressure in the tubes that's pulling the water up gets too low, and gas bubbles arise that block the transport, and we've developed ways of measuring the extent of vascular failure, and we've discovered that different species have quite different tolerances. So some species are quite vulnerable, and others are quite resistant. And so this then, if you go out in a landscape and measure the amount of vascular failure that's going on. People have noticed over the years that there's a relationship with mortality. So if you get over, say, 60, 70% loss of vascular function, this is an important disposing factor for mortality.
That's quite the image, an aspen having a heart attack, just like a human would.
Yeah.
I guess it is. Trees do have a extensive vascular system.
Yeah, I mean, the function is quite different. You know, it's just piping water from the roots through those pores that Bill mentioned, kind of a water for carbon trade-off. And so the two hypotheses were either the plant's still accessing CO2 but losing water and developing hydraulic failure, or in order to avoid hydraulic failure, it's closing those pores and saving itself, but starving itself in consequence.
Now, I'm reading that you say that trees stressed by drought develop the equivalent of blood clots.
And they're embolisms, you know,
okay.
Gas bubbles, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Basically, the pressure drops low enough that it sucks air into these pipes.
Hmm.
And then they it's like vapor lock in your gas line.
And then it's pretty much downhill for that tree.
I think, you know, I mean, it's pretty complicated because some plants can recover. You know, they have reversal mechanisms, so they can dissolve those gas bubbles. Other plants seem not able to do that, and then there also seems to be a threshold. If there's enough failure, there's sort of a tipping point where they have trouble, you know, getting going again. And at least in this case of this aspen study, and also in the pinion mortality, seems to be around 60-70% loss of hydraulic conductance in the vascular system. It may be sort of a critical tipping point.
Bill Anderegg, what are the implications then? The theory is going in, it was either trees died of starvation or died of thirst. We lean now toward dying of thirst. What's the implication?
Well, the first implication is really actually looking at what drove sudden aspen decline. And this is one of the things we've been very interested in. But it's become reasonably well known that it was triggered by drought, but importantly, it was a very hot drought, hot in the spring and the summer. And what that tells us is this really could be a snapshot of the future, especially future droughts due to climate change. The other implications are the hope is that understanding how trees die during drought, whether it's due to this starvation or due to this hydraulic failure, is really going to allow us to have some sort of predictive power as to when and where trees might become vulnerable or susceptible to drought. So that's really the next steps. It's research that's still ongoing, but the hope is to take this knowledge, like a physician that's just made a diagnosis on how a tree is sick, and actually come up with some sort of prescription or at least some sort of prediction as to what might happen.
Now, predictions are always problematic. The predictions I've read are that the West probably will have drier weather and probably hotter, maybe hotter in the spring and summer.
Yeah, we're quite confident that the West is going to be experiencing hotter weather in coming decades, and I think that's the important part to take from this sad sudden aspen decline story, is that essentially even if the droughts don't necessarily get too much drier, a hotter drought is more stressful for trees.
Professor Sperry, will this give us any information about whether these trees and other trees that have experienced decline will grow back, or if this is a permanent shift?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, to the extent that it's linked to climate, and it would seem to suggest there might not be that much potential for long-term recovery. It might transition to a different vegetation type. Because the climate change is happening rapidly enough that it's probably unlikely that trees would be able to evolve, in time to survive future droughts. drought. So I guess, you know, to the extent that these drought events might become more frequent, you're going to see shifts in the ranges of aspens and other trees.
Okay, let's. We just have a couple of minutes left. Let's go to another caller. Paul in Vernal. Welcome to the program, Paul.
Hi. We've got land on a place called Diamond Mountain. It's not too far away from Colorado and Wyoming. Are you still there?
Yes, go ahead.
Our aspen have been bored with insects, the old stand, and then immediately a new stand would come and get about 4 inches thick, and then the borers would bore those also. And this has gone on and on now for a period of 25 years. I'm just wondering about that.
Either of our guests have an answer?
I can take an answer. Okay. I think, yeah, that's it's a fairly common experience. Aspen are a tree that's fairly vulnerable to all sorts of insects boring and chewing on them. They tend to be pretty fast growing, so their response is, rather than really trying to defend against these insects, trying to regrow from this common root network. And so I'd say that's a pretty common experience. That's, you know, that seems to be something that afflicts aspens throughout the western U.S. So it's something that happens a lot. It's probably it doesn't sound like it's very well tied to any specific drought, which is what really sets sudden aspen decline apart from your sort of typical insect attacks.
Paul, does that answer your question?
Well, yeah, this has gone on for a long period of years, and of course the old stand was quite mature before these borers slowly killed them. So they're a relatively new thing to us. I mean, new like 50 years or so.
Well, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul, for that question. We have maybe 30 seconds. We can try to get a very brief question in from Carl in St. George. Carl, if you could be very fast.
Okay. Hi, gentlemen. We have land up on Cedar Mountain above Cedar City, and we notice these big splotches of quakeys that are dying. And number one, if your hypothesis is true, it seems to me you can go to areas where there isn't drought and find that the trees are not dying or they are dying. Secondly, it's the kill isn't uniform over the whole forest. It seems to be worse in certain places where if it was drought, it would be uniform. And secondly, when the drought is over, why aren't these trees coming back if your, again, hypothesis is true?
Okay, thanks, Carl. And we have about 30 seconds for an answer there right at the end of the program here.
Sure. So I'll just take a few of those really quickly. There's a lot of reasons that we would actually expect that it wouldn't be uniform over the whole mountain, really. Essentially, there's a lot of things that differ as you move across the mountain, not only in aspen genetics, but also in whether you're in a drainage or an exposed slope or a south or north-facing slope. All these really matter for the sort of drought stress that an aspen would feel. And then the other thing is it's a great question. We have looked over a much broader region to see where drought was less severe. Do you see less mortality? So, for instance, the drought was relatively less severe up in Idaho and Wyoming. And, in fact, you do see a lot less mortality of aspens.
We'll have to leave it there. We've been talking with Bill Anderick, doctoral student and researcher at Stanford. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And with the University of Utah biology professor John Sperry, thanks to you.
Thank you, Tom.
We were talking about sudden aspen decline, and thanks for listening. By the way, tomorrow we'll be talking about those shootings in Ogden. We'll have some police officers or ex-police officers on, and some reporters going to give you a chance to talk about those shootings in Ogden. That's tomorrow on the program. Thanks for listening today.